Tonight on PBS News Weekend, calls for a ceasefire in Israel's war with Hamas intensify as the humanitarian crisis in Gaza worsens.
We are suffering. Every day we are suffering. We only have bread and water to quiet the kids so they sleep at night.
Then how Israel's judicial reform protest movement is refocusing its energy to help those in need after the Hamas attack. And what prescription and over-the-counter drug shortages mean for doctors and patients caught in the middle. Good evening, I'm John Yang. Tonight, the Israeli military says it has divided Gaza in two and its troops have surrounded Gaza City. Israeli media reports that soldiers could move into Gaza City in the next 48 hours. The human toll is rising. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 9,700 Palestinians have died, though it's not clear how many were Hamas fighters. The Israeli military says 29 soldiers have died in Gaza ground operations. Special correspondent Leila Milana Allen has our report.
Down Gaza's main north-south highway, civilians walk towards what they hope is safety. The Israel Defense Forces warned residents in the north to leave during a four-hour pause in airstrikes Sunday. Those that left carried whatever and whoever they could. But airstrikes also continued outside the north. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said at least 38 people died in a strike on the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. Among those who lost loved ones, photojournalist Mohammed Al-Alul, who was working for the Turkish newspaper Andalu. Four of his children were killed. His wife is in critical condition.
What happened was that I was doing my job and reporting. I got the news that Al-Maghazi camp has been bombed. Little by little, more news was delivered, and I found out it is my home.
At the Rafah border crossing, foreigners and injured Gazans have been unable to leave since Saturday. U.S. officials said the Hamas-controlled government wanted it closed until more Gazans, injured in Israeli strikes on hospitals and ambulances, were allowed to evacuate. That's leaving dual passport holders like Majid al-Huwayi in limbo.
I ask the German government to intervene in a stronger way with all parties. Things get more dangerous in Gaza with every day that passes.
The IDF maintains that its strikes target Hamas locations underneath hospitals. It released this undated video purporting to show Hamas infrastructure under a hospital in Gaza City. On CBS's Face the Nation this morning, Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer said the majority of about 400 Americans in Gaza had now left.
Over the last several days, through pretty intensive negotiations with all sides relevant to this conflict, we have been able to get out more than 300 Americans, lawful permanent residents, and their family members.
The day before, President Joe Biden expressed optimism about getting Israel to agree to temporarily stop fighting to allow more aid into Gaza.
Mr. President, any progress on a humanitarian pause?
Yes.
On Sunday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken expanded on the one-word answer.
This is a process. Israel's raised important questions about how humanitarian pauses would work. We've got to answer those questions.
Blinken also made an unannounced visit to the West Bank Sunday, meeting with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. In response, protesters filled the streets of Ramallah.
And Ramallah isn't the only area in the West Bank threatening to boil over, John.
Leila, I know you've been spending a lot of time on the West Bank. Can you tell us, what are you seeing there?
I have, and Palestinians in the West Bank are saying that they feel like they are being persecuted as though they were Hamas as well. We've seen a huge escalation in raids by the Israel Defense Forces into towns and camps in the West Bank. And not only that, but also airstrikes, which is very unusual in the West Bank. More than 1,300 Palestinians have been arrested, more than 100 killed by security forces in the past few weeks. And the second issue, of course, is the Palestinian Authority. Now, they are theoretically still the government in Gaza. It's just just that Hamas is the party that runs things there. Fatah, which is the party that's in charge in the West Bank side of things, has been called upon now by the Israelis to come back in and run things in Gaza after the war. But they're very concerned about how that will be seen if they're seen as complicit with the Israelis. So there's a lot of concern about, after all this devastation, what happens next and what the future is for any Palestinian peace solution or state.
Leila Malana Allen in Tel Aviv tonight. Thank you very much. Ukraine's president called on the United States to provide more funding in his country's ongoing war with Russia. President Biden has pressed Congress to pass a spending bill that includes billions in weapons aid for Ukraine. But so far, only a bill with money for Israel is advancing in Congress. On NBC's Meet the Press, President Volodymyr Zelensky warned that without additional help, the conflict will spread. He spoke in both English and Ukrainian.
If Russia will kill all of us, they will attack NATO countries, and you will send your sons and daughters. And it will be, I'm sorry, but the price will be higher.
Ukraine is defending both the European Union, the European continent, and our common values.
The Russian military reported today it has successfully test-launched an intercontinental ballistic missile designed to carry nuclear warheads. Video from the Russian Defense Ministry shows it launching from a new nuclear submarine somewhere in Russia's northern White Sea. It's not clear when the test took place. Voters went to the polls in Moldova today for nationwide local elections amid claims of Russian meddling. The former Soviet republic sits between Romania and Ukraine and last year became a candidate for EU membership. Today's vote will elect nearly 900 mayors and 11,000 local councillors. Authorities there maintain Russia has been conducting hybrid warfare to undermine the vote. And 2 days ago, the prime minister announced a ban on candidates from a pro-Russian party. And there are two new winners at the New York City Marathon and one new course record. Tamarat Tola of Ethiopia won the men's race in 2 hours, 4 minutes, and 58 seconds. That's 8 seconds faster than the record set in 2011. In the women's race, it came down to the final stretch when Helen Obiri of Kenya pulled ahead to win. She also won the Boston Marathon in April. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, a look at prescription and over-the-counter drug shortages across the country, and the story of the first Native American to earn a medical degree.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
For months, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's sweeping judicial overhaul proposals had divided Israelis, triggering massive protests across the nation virtually every weekend. But on October 7th, the day of the bloody assault on southern Israel by Hamas fighters, groups protesting against Netanyahu's government quickly turned their resources toward aiding Israeli soldiers and civilians affected by the attack and Israel's subsequent war on Hamas. One such group is Bonat Alternativa, in English, Building an Alternative. It's a women's group founded in 2020. Earlier, I spoke with Lee Hoffman-Agiv, the group's field operations manager. I asked her about what effect the Hamas attack had on her and her work.
October 7th changed everything, literally everything. We woke up and by 9:30 a.m., we were already in a meeting. And the first thing we said that there is no protest. Okay, no demonstrations, no protest. Our main concern now is how to survive this crisis. We started building a website that will help evacuees find new homes to make a connection between people that were looking for a home and people that were offering a space or a home voluntarily. So all of our attention was only to this horrible situation.
And talk a little bit more about the activities, what you've done, the group has been doing since October 7th. And I'm curious if the existing organization, if it was easier sort of to get up to speed.
Yes. Since we are already about 80 different communities around Israel, then each community was transformed into a mini emergency organization. So, for example, a few women took charge of cooking, a few women took charge of sending equipment to soldiers, a few women took charge of giving support to families who their kids were kidnapped or murdered. We were able to do that very quickly since we are activists. So that happened in hours. Okay, in a few hours, it was already working.
Does this change in direction signal a change in attitude about the Netanyahu government, or is this not so much supporting the Netanyahu government as much as it is supporting Israel and Israelis?
So there is no simple answer. Most of us, we don't trust the government, obviously. I don't see how you can trust the government. And the debate now is about the timing. So some people think that you should go all in now and ask for the government to resign. And some people will say, wait until the end of the war. But then I say, like, so who decides when does the war end? So you can even ask me, like, during the day, I might change my answer.
Was your mistrust already high before October 7th, or has this sort of compounded your mistrust?
It's the same. I didn't trust them before. They were really a group of incapable people, most of them. But now we paid the price, okay? We paid the highest price. The difference is that now more people feel the same way. People that voted for this government are saying, I'm sorry. So it's not like they're taking responsibility, but they feel very bad for trusting them.
Before this, when there were the protests over the Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan, Israel seemed to be very divided between those on the left, the ultra-Orthodox, the ultra-religious on the other side. Has this had the effect of bringing people together, do you think?
Maybe some are more willing to spend time together or to talk to each other. But I have to say that women's rights is not a right or left issue. We have women in Bonot Alternativa, which are ultra-Orthodox as well. And sometimes I can be very, very mad at the situation that is happening with the ultra-Orthodox group in the government, with their leaders. I can be very angry with the settlers. And sometimes I can talk to them and find the common values. For example, them as mothers, since I'm a mother, we can relate, we can talk about things. It's more about opening your eyes and seeing the situation as it is.
Is there a sense that the issues you were working on before October 7th, women's rights, that what happened on October 7th sort of overwhelms that?
So on one hand, we feel like we're starting all over. We do know that Hamas used rape as a weapon. They kidnapped children. They kidnapped women. We have in this war more women killed than in any other war. Now we're talking about dozens of women killed, soldiers, police officers, paramedics. So you hear about women that are heroes. And at the same time, you have the extremists who are talking about the fact, you know, that women are hurting the stability of the army. And also, when you look at this government, there are no women in the government. You have only 5 ministers, women ministers at the moment. You have no women in the cabinet. You have no women in the table of the decision-making. And they're just looking to the other way and ignoring women completely. Our women in Bonot Alternativa are outraged, you know? So on one hand, they will not go and protest and say, what about the women? But we will act on that subject because no one else will.
Lee Hoffman-Ageev of Building an Alternative, thank you very much, and we wish you well in what may be difficult days ahead.
Thank you very much for taking the time to look at this very important subject.
All year long, drug shortages have disrupted hospitals and pharmacies, Medications for ADHD, chemotherapy, and diabetes, among others, have constantly been in low supply. And now RSV treatments for infants are the latest to be affected. Allie Rogan tells us what's driving the shortages and what could be done about it.
If you've recently struggled to get a prescription filled or buy certain over-the-counter medicines, you're not alone. By late spring this year, there were 309 ongoing drug shortages in the U.S., the highest in nearly a decade. Experts blame supply chain gaps, manufacturing delays, and spikes in demand for the shortages. But what does that mean for doctors, parents, and patients who are caught in the middle? Michael Gagneau is a senior director at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists. Thank you so much for joining us. Michael, drug shortages are not that uncommon, but to have so many at one time is. What are some of the factors contributing to the situation?
Well, there are several reasons for drug shortages. What we've seen recently are some demand spikes, as you noted. There are weight loss medications used for diabetes. There's unprecedented demand for those. Attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder medications, commonly known as Adderall or Ritalin, those have been in short supply because of high demand. The other side of that is manufacturing delays, and sometimes it's a disruption due to quality. It's not a problem with the quality of the product, but it's a process issue that has held up production. And if anyone has heard of the ongoing oncology drug shortages, things we use to treat cancers, chemotherapy drugs, those have been caused because of some of these quality issues prohibiting release of the products. So really, there are a lot of different causes, and we've even seen geopolitical threats to the supply chain. And of course, during COVID-19, we had supply chain disruptions across the board.
I want to talk more about the cancer drug shortage that you mentioned. How are hospitals, how are doctors dealing with that?
Yeah, these shortages are really challenging, mostly because it's not easy to just switch between drugs. Usually when we're out of a drug, we have to switch regimens completely. And that means that there's different outcomes that can be associated with those regimens. They may not be as effective. They may have different or worse side effects. And so really there's a decision that has to be made when deciding who gets that treatment. Is there a curative intent? Is there a chance that we'll cure that cancer? Or are we doing something to try to prolong their overall survival? That may play into which patients get the drug and which ones don't.
Let's talk now about the antibody treatment that was approved for RSV. There are shortages there, too. How is that affecting patients?
Well, this one is also an unusual one. This is an increase in demand causing the shortage. And actually, to say increase is a little bit of a misnomer because it's a new drug. There's really no precedent set as far as demand. So the manufacturer tried to project how much of the medication would be used. And it's obvious that they did not project enough to manufacture enough to treat all the patients that they plan to treat. There are actually several things at play. You may just look at birthing numbers and wonder, well, looking at these statistics, why didn't they forecast enough? But they had to order a lot of this drug ahead of time to know how much to make. The other variable is the fact that there is a vaccine available. And if the mother receives a vaccine within a certain time frame, the child does not need this monoclonal antibody. So what we will hopefully see is as the season goes on, more mothers receive that vaccine, and then the infant is born protected already and will not need this antibody. But for right now, there's a really high demand for that drug.
Now, we know there are several federal agencies involved in dealing with these shortages. The FDA has a role to play, HHS, even the Department of Defense. How can those different agencies work together to put a stop to this?
Well, they already have worked together a little bit. Back in 2018, and into 2019, several agencies worked together to develop a report on the root causes of drug shortages. Two of the root causes that are really interesting that we're focused on are the economics of the drug shortage problem. We're talking about a lot of older, generic, sterile injectable drugs. These are difficult to manufacture because of the sterility, but they also have very slim profit margins. So there's really not a lot of economic interest in getting into this market or expanding a portfolio into this market. The other side of that is quality. When we're purchasing the drugs, we don't really have any insight into that quality. With our FDA system of pass-fail approval, we have to assume everything is equal. So we really have no other piece of information to base purchasing on other than the price. That leads to a race to the bottom in pricing, and it incentivizes hospitals and other providers to buy the cheapest product.
And I know that that's something that you at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists has been pushing to get implemented, something that would allow you to factor in quality, not just low prices. Tell me more about that, and what other solutions on a policy level do you think need to be implemented to avoid future drug shortages like this?
The key is providing purchasers with more information about the products we're buying. How much investment in the resiliency of the supply chain? Are they using multiple sources for the active pharmaceutical ingredient? Do they have redundancies built into their systems? And if they do, then the market should reward that. And maybe that marginal increase in price is something that providers will pay. We do know that drug shortages cost the United States healthcare system quite a bit of money. There was a survey in 2019 that estimated about $360 million healthcare dollars in the U.S. are spent every year just in labor costs. So the marginal increase on the price of a generic injectable is something that buyers may invest in if they know that it's going to help resolve these shortages.
Michael Gagneau with the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
November is Native American Heritage Month, a celebration of the traditions and languages of U.S. indigenous communities. Tonight, the story of the first Native American to earn a medical degree, a pioneer at a time when she had few rights, either as a woman or as an American Indian.
A child of the 19th century American frontier, Dr. Susan LaFleche Picot was a trailblazer in Native American healthcare, as they were moved to Indian reservations, sometimes after brutal wars with U.S. soldiers. She was the youngest daughter of Mary Gale and Joseph LaFleche, who was of French and Indian descent, and was the last recognized chief of the Omaha. She was born in 1865, more than a decade after her father signed a treaty with the government, giving up much of the Omaha's ancestral home. They'd been moved to a reservation in northeastern Nebraska. As white settlers pushed the frontier farther and farther west, her father saw assimilation as the key to survival. Many Omaha rejected that, but his children took it to heart. Embracing her heritage, Susan ventured into the world of white America, confronting prejudice along the way. She graduated second in the class of 1886 at what is now Hampton University, a historically black school in Virginia. And at a time when women were considered ill-suited to be physicians, she enrolled at Woman's Medical College of Pennsylvania, the nation's first medical school for women. She completed the three-year program in just two, graduating at the top of her class. She was now a doctor, though as a woman she could not vote, and as a Native American, U.S. law did not consider her a citizen. Then 24 years old, she chose to return to the Omaha Reservation, becoming the sole doctor for 1,200 people across more than 400 square miles, including the Winnebago Reservation. Armed with formal medical training, she pushed for better hygiene and food sanitation, including window screens to keep out disease-carrying flies. She tackled the health disparities facing Native Americans, including widespread disease, suicide, mental illness, and alcohol abuse. She led temperance campaigns, persuading the government to ban liquor sales on reservations. Her own husband, Henry, a Yankton Sioux, died in 1905 of tuberculosis, aggravated by alcoholism. In 1913, even as her own health faltered, she opened the first privately funded hospital on a Native reservation. The Walt Hill, Nebraska facility treated all people in need, not just those from the reservation. The hospital closed in 1940, and today the building is a National Historic Landmark. More than a century after her death in 1915 at age 50, the modern-day fruits of her efforts can be seen in health facilities on reservations. But it's also not hard to imagine her among those who complain that the U.S. Indian Health Service is understaffed and underfunded. Her determination is reflected in the face of a bronze sculpture in downtown Lincoln, Nebraska, and in her words inscribed next to it, "I shall always fight good and hard, even if I have to fight alone."
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.